So good evening, everybody. I'll begin with the motivation. And so understanding the mind is essential to understanding Buddhism. And actually understanding the mind is essential to some peace and clarity. So studying and understanding Lo Rig provides very helpful tools to understanding our minds. And the process of becoming a Buddha, a fully awakened one, requires systematically purifying and enhancing the mind. And since the body and mind, although associated, are not inseparably linked, they have different substantial causes. This means that the development of the mind is not limited to that of the body. The continuum of the body ceases at death, but that of the mind does not. The mind is an impermanent phenomenon, changing each moment, having the nature of clear light, pure in its nature. It is stained by adventitious defilements, but these can be removed. The mind can be totally purified. And the stages in this process of purification constitute the levels of progress toward awakening. And so we study Lo Rig to be able to use our full potential, understand our mind, and then use that understanding to tap into our vast potential. So tonight, as we review, let's really rejoice that we are creating the causes for full awakening. And we do all of this for the benefit of all. So first I want to say that this topic is quite complex, and I barely understand it, so I've really used references, Venerable Children and Mind in Tibetan Buddhism, Lati Rinpoche's book, and also a teaching that Geshe Tekchok did on Lo Rig. So those are my sources. When I study a topic like this, if I can't put it into some relevance to my practice, it's quite hard for me to learn it. So tonight I'm going to try to keep putting it into the relevance of our practice today, what we're doing. And since much of it is about terms and new vocabulary, it's kind of easy to get discouraged with the content. So it helps to keep, I think, this broad view of how this fits in and what's its utility is in what we're doing here. So I first want to just review what awareness and knowledge is, what this topic is about. So it's primarily an identification of the different types of minds, of consciousnesses, which occur in our mental continuum. And it introduces vocabulary connected with the mind and a means of training in the process of reasoning. And consciousnesses then are examined mainly by dividing it into types and subtypes from different points of view. And through study, then, we get a sense of these variety of consciousnesses and their functions and their interrelationships. And the primary source of awareness and knowledge comes from the great Indian commentators, Dignaga's Compendium on Prime Cognition and Dharmakirti's Seven Treatises on Prime Cognition. And in one of the books, I read that this sevenfold division of awareness and knowledge, only four of them, the direct perceivers, inferential cognizers, doubt, and wrong consciousnesses, were mentioned by name either by Dignaga or Dharmakirti. The remaining three, subsequent cognizers, correctly assuming consciousness, and inattentive perceivers, were not explicitly mentioned. And so this is where the Tibetans contributed to this topic, so both in systematizing it and refining the use of terminology. And then the other question I had about this content, this topic, was since what we primarily study here is Prasangika tenet, ways of looking at the teachings, my question was, how does this information then help me with that? And I found some wonderful information by Anne Klein in her book, Knowing, Naming, and Negation. And she writes, studying Satrantika following reasoning is significant for understanding Madhyamaka in three important ways. Its description of ultimate truths as specifically characterized phenomena helps identify that which is negated in the Prasangika Madhyamaka theory on emptiness. Secondly, its discussion of the relationship between thought and direct perception provides a rationale for the technique or modus operandi of analytical reflection. And so this is especially helpful when we're dealing with phenomena that is very obscure. And then third, its presentation of negative phenomena, which we didn't study much about, but nonetheless, especially the non-affirming negatives, gives an important context for Prasangika discussions of emptiness, a non-affirming negative, which is described as the mere absence of inherent existence. So after I read that, then it really seemed to me like this was quite a foundational piece which is needed in which to then build upon our understanding and to be able to use this knowledge to understand the Prasangika way of looking at. And then the other thing I was thinking is, when I was studying this, I had a conversation with Ruby this morning at breakfast that Lohrig reminds me of when I studied chemistry. All these terms, all these equations that didn't seem to have any relevancy at all. And it took quite a while for me to see how it had some usefulness. It's quite a steep learning curve. And so Lohrig to me is quite like that. So I think just to continue to go over it and over it, then we get more clear about it. So we're doing the quiz tonight, and with all these questions, I'm going to give a little filler, a little background about the topic so that it's within some context always, instead of just throwing out the questions. So the first question is in reference to inattentive perceivers. Does somebody have the definition of inattentive perceiver? Even though that's not on the quiz.
Well, the closest I have is that the engaged object to the mind, apprehending it, the engaged object appears to the mind, but the mind is unable to ascertain it because it's focused on some other object of the senses or something in the conceptual mind that's drawn in.
Yeah. So the simple definition is a mind to which the object appears but is not ascertained. The specific, from our root text, it's a knower to which this specifically characterized phenomenon that is its engaged object, clearly appears, but which is unable to induce ascertainment with respect to it is the definition of an inattentive perceiver. So then the first question is, according to Satrantika, what is a specifically characterized object? So, pardon? Oh, yeah, yeah. So it is a specifically characterized object. A specifically characterized object is a phenomenon which is ultimately able to perform a function, an existent. So in the from the book Mind in Tibetan Buddhism, it talks a bit about specifically characterized phenomena. Which I thought was kind of important and interesting, so I thought I'd read it. In the Satrantika system, specifically characterized phenomena is synonymous with an impermanent phenomena. The use of the term specifically characterized phenomena emphasizes that, unlike permanent phenomena, which are mere imputations by thought, impermanent things have their own uncommon or specific characteristics, which can appear to a direct perceiver. An awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained is a type of direct perceiver. Set forth separately within the sevenfold division of awareness and knowers to emphasize that not all direct perceivers are minds which realize their objects. Like direct perceivers, though, they are non-conceptual consciousnesses, which are non-mistaken with respect to the object they are comprehending. However, these are minds which, for some reason, such as one's attention being intently directed elsewhere, or the duration of the consciousness being too brief to be noticed, are unable to subsequently induce ascertainment, knowing that one had that particular perception. And one of the examples they give is walking down the street, intently engaged in conversation with somebody, and having an awareness of people walking by you. But later, when you try to recall, you cannot bring up the image of those people. You can't recall who walked by you. And such a mind is not mistaken, for that it does not perceive something that is not actually so. But it has not introduced, an element of error, so it is included among direct perceivers. But it doesn't provide reliable information and has no factor of certainty. It is not considered to realize its object or to be incontrovertible. So next topic we're going to start on is inferences. And these are important. Since the root cause of the endless round of birth, aging, sickness, and death is the misapprehension of self where there is none, to free ourselves from this suffering is to identify this misapprehension through reasoning. And an inference is the end result of this specific process of reasoning. And I thought to just go through this whole process of using these seven consciousnesses that we've been studying about to just review how we go through something and get clear about it, to see the sequence. So we first begin with a wrong view, and we can use the example of the idea that there's a substantially existent self. And so as long as that idea is held forcefully, what kind of consciousness is that?
Wrong.
Yeah. Then hearing teachings of selflessness, one might begin to wonder whether, in fact, there is such a self. At this point, what are we generating?
Doubt.
And what are the three types of doubt? How do we go through that process?
Wrong.
The correct one, yeah. So first, initially think that there probably is a self, that's doubt tending toward the fact. Then through repeatedly thinking about this, then we pass to the stage of equal doubt. wondering whether or not, and really not having a conclusion one way or the other, and that eventually developing doubt tending to the fact, in which we feel that there probably is no self, but is nonetheless, we're still uncertain. So then the next step in the development of the view of selflessness is to generate a correct assuming consciousness, one that definitely decides that there is no substantially existent self. At this point, what are we holding? What kind of view?
Correct assumption.
Yeah, correct view. Yeah. So again, though, even though we have a correct assumption, and this initial generation of correct assumption is a very powerful experience, we still haven't realized, of course, selflessness. So now the next process is that we contemplate this again and 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 again using reasoning. And continually going over it and over it, seeking to develop a certainty from which one cannot be shaken. And for this conclusion to have the force of reasoned conviction, one must go through the steps of this investigation over and over again. One's consciousness throughout this process of familiarization are correct assumptions. When it is brought to the point of unwavering certainty, one generates an inference. And at that point, one's realization is still conceptual. It's still getting at selflessness only by way of an image. And the goal is to develop one's realization still more and bring it finally to the point of direct perception, in which all need for an image has disappeared and one's mental consciousness is able to contact its object directly. And the final purpose of practices of mental imagery or visualization is not to create a certain type of image in the mind, it's to change the mind. And so even though the image isn't kind of the important thing, it's integral to the process of getting to seeing the object directly. So an inferential cognizer is a type of conceptual consciousness which realizes or incontrovertibly gets at an object of comprehension which cannot be initially realized by direct perception. And again, it's generated through the process of reasoning, and it is said to be produced in dependence on a correct sign acting as its basis. And so we can use the familiar worldly example as we look across the view here and in the neighbor's house, and we see smoke billowing from the house. And we immediately infer that inside the house there is fire. The basis, the sign independence on which this inference was generated, was the presence of smoke. Because there is a fact of an invariable or constant relationship between the presence of an effect, in this case the smoke, and the preceding existence of its cause, fire, we can correctly infer that fire is present. Such knowledge is not direct perception, for we did not actually see the fire. Nonetheless, it is valid, reliable knowledge. When we have incontrovertible inferential cognition, it is as reliable a form of knowledge as a direct perceiver. The only difference is that direct perceiver contacts its object directly and non-mistakenly, whereas the inferential cognizer, being conceptual, must get at its object through the medium of an object. This generic image appears to thought as if it were the actual object, although it is not. And in this respect, a conceptual consciousness is mistaken with respect to the object that is appearing to it. This element of error does not interfere with the accuracy with which that consciousness comprehends the object represented by the generic image, and so it is correct and incontrovertible knower. Inferential cognizers are, by definition, not mistaken with respect to the object comprehended, being incontrovertible in the sense that their realization is firm. This gives them their force and validity. So there are three types of inferential cognizers. What are the three types?
Depending on authority testimony. Inference through renown. Inference by the power
of the fact. So the first one, the inference depending on authoritative testimony or inference through belief. This is an inference acquired through belief in a valid statement, such as the word of the Buddha. So an example would be the fact that ethical conduct in this life leads to a happy rebirth, or that generosity leads to wealth in a future life. These two statements by the Buddha are true because they are not contradicted by the threefold analysis, which we'll get to in a bit. Then inference through renown. This is an inferential understanding that can arise through knowing something that is commonly held to be true. So when a name is given to a particular object, similar objects are then conventionally called by the same name. So even though this looks like a weird telephone, a spaceship telephone, nonetheless, it's similar enough and functions in the same way, so we can call it telephone. So these objects of inference through renown only exist really by being labeled. And then inference by the power of the fact, these are called correct signs. And this is so called because it is through the quality of the facts of the phenomena that we are able to use logical reasoning to understand it. The power of the fact means that the quality is there through the very existence of the phenomena. So an example is fire. It has the nature of hot and burning, and the qualities of hot and burning exist because of the fire itself. As soon as fire arises, the qualities arise by the power of the fact. Or another example would be, as soon as the aggregates arise, they arise with their own fact of impermanence. And we can also say that the aggregates are miserable, or suffering, selfless, empty, because these qualities also arise through the power of the fact. And realizing these qualities by the power of the fact is inferential understanding through the nature of the phenomena. And these natural powers are stable and cannot be changed by anyone, not even the Buddha. So, think of some inferences especially related to your life. Can you think of some that you adhere to? Maybe in a worldly way first.
I have one that's, I work hard physically because it helps my mind to rest.
You work hard physically because it helps your mind to rest. Okay. Okay. Others?
I need to keep physically active because it is a cooperative cause for health and longevity.
You need to be physically active because it is a cooperative cause to health and longevity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to share? Okay. Let's go on to the next question. Pardon?
I went the wrong conception route.
Oh.
mine are all wrong conceptions. I don't know. You want to go there?
Sure.
There's a whole series.
Okay.
This is my wrong conception conundrum. I am loved because I am praised. I am praised because I am loved. When I am not praised, it's because I'm not loved. I am disliked because I am not praised.
Oh.
I am worthwhile because I am liked or loved. Therefore, I am worthwhile because I am praised. These are wrong conceptions, but I do live by them. Yeah. This is big.
Thank you for sharing
those.
You're
welcome.
Yeah. Mm. Those are big.
They're really big.
Mm-hmm.
They are wrong conceptions.
That was very good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. We'd like
I
to
have value.
Yeah. We'd like to praise you for those.
Mm. Okay.
So the next question is inferences are relevant to our Dharma practice and our daily life. Often we don't use them correctly. Can you identify an inference that is relevant to your Dharma practice, and what are your reasons for believing in the inference? So it's harder. Somebody? Anybody?
I have one. I didn't write it down, though. But
okay.
What I have is Venerable Thupten Chodron is a reliable spiritual guide.
Uh-huh.
On the basis of the clarity and wisdom of her teachings, on the basis of the observed action of seeing her keep precepts over a number of years, on the basis of her reputation as a teacher, and on the basis of her kind of renown, her great Dharma knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think.
Ruby, can they hear, do you think, up so close?
No one has complained so far.
Okay, good. I'm so thankful.
Can we check to hear if
you
could repeat what
Venerable Thupten
just said?
Can you hear the people commenting in the room? And we have a lag time too, so.
Well, someone says you have contagious laughter.
Okay.
I guess so.
Okay. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, great.
So, I need to hear teachings on the same topic again and again, because it is one of the causes for deeper understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But is that not actually an inference, and in fact something you know to be true because you experience the knowledge later on? If you study, then you understand more, and you know you understand more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a logical fact,
mm-hmm.
not an inference.
Logical
no one can
fact.
Prove it that you know more except you, because you've learned more.
Mm-hmm.
Because one time you did not know 4 times 4 equals 16, yeah. But then you studied and now you know 4 times 4 equals 16.
Well, others could know if you showed them your knowledge. No? I don't know. Anybody else have a comment?
I think the inference has to be, you know, you're proving it for yourself, you're not proving it for anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of saying the same thing.
Mm.
But I suppose the question is, what's the proof? In that inference, what's the proof?
Mm.
Would you say it one more time?
I need to hear teachings on the same topic again and again, because it's one of the causes for deeper understanding.
So hearing teachings again and again is a cause for understanding. That's the... Is that the proof? Is that the... What is...
The pervasion, yeah.
So I need to hear teachings again and again, because that is a cause for deeper understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
so is that thesis true?
Yes. I have one here, but it's not that one.
The reason in the subject. So
mm-hmm.
the last part C of it was what?
because it's one of the causes for deeper understanding.
So when you have, can that apply to the subject, that you can have deeper understanding?
Yes.
The presence of the reason in the subject.
Right.
Because it is one of the causes for deeper understanding.
Deeper understanding.
Right.
I need to hear teachings on the same topic again and again.
Yeah, so it is possible for you to have deeper understanding because you're understanding the inherent existence.
And then the next one was...
The reverse or the counter.
Well, no, then you have the pervasion and then the counter-pervasion. Those don't relate to the subject.
If you don't listen to
teachers. If C is true, then B is true. If you have certain teachings, your reason was teaching, but your teachings a lot.
Again, because it's one of the causes for deeper understanding.
Oh, it's the deeper understanding that what's C in your thing? ABC. A is the subject, B is the predicate. It's necessarily true that I'll gain deeper understanding
if I listen to the teachings.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Is it true?
I don't think it's true necessarily.
Well, not necessarily.
I don't think it is either.
The subject here is I.
Right, the subject is I.
The subject isn't in here.
Right, in the counter-pervasion.
So the pervasion and the counter-pervasion are only looking at the relationship between the predicate and the reason. It's A, B, and C. A is the subject, B is the predicate, C is the reason. The presence of the reason in the subject is C compared to A.
Right.
The pervasion is C compared to B, but it's then stated in the form of
if it is reason, then it is necessarily the predicate.
Right. Then the next one is if not B, then not
right.
C.
Right. Because if you listen to the teachings again and again, but have an inattentive perceiver every single time, you wouldn't necessarily.
That's true.
But that isn't in there exactly.
No, you will get something.
If you state it, if C, then necessarily B, right?
So if I have a deeper understanding, I necessarily need to hear teaching.
No. Well, there's no I. Well, I don't know enough to know the word. Sorry.
Yeah.
I have to get my cheat sheet.
If I hear teachings again and again, I will necessarily get a deeper understanding.
When it's C, then it's... I'm going to go get that sheet.
Okay.
You can go on, and I'll come back with this.
Okay. All right. Well,
I'll... We'll come back to this one.
Yeah.
I actually think it's changed my mind. I think it's true.
Do you? Yeah. Okay. So let me do one that I wrote out here.
Yes.
So the aggregates are impermanent because they are products.
Right.
So... the basic agreement, establishing the presence of the reason on the subject. Subject is aggregates. Understanding that the person is a product because they are produced by causes and conditions. That's the basic agreement. The forward pervasion, understanding that the reason is pervaded by the predicate, impermanence. If something is a product, it is necessarily impermanent. The reverse or counter pervasion, understanding that the non-predicate is pervaded by the non-sign. Products necessarily do not belong to the class of permanent, or if it is permanent, it cannot be a product. So when you apply this, the aggregates are impermanent because there are products, it works in this syllogism.
Right.
Yeah? Now Venerable Tarp is back. Good.
Yeah, I have a spec. Keep going because I want to find their exact word. I guess she did say it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but we have to just substitute things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the subject is
I.
The predicate is
need to hear teachings.
Study teachings.
On the same topic again.
Study teachings.
Need to hear teachings.
Teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Teachings. What you're trying to prove is I Need to hear teachings.
Yeah.
The reason? Because
I will gain deeper understanding.
No, because of cause.
I actually think you need to reverse this around. I will gain deeper understanding. Because I listen to teachings.
So,
I think that's more accurate.
Yep.
So then it would be I, deeper
understanding.
I will gain.
Well, you could say that, but I don't think it's exactly. Anyway, then because the reason is because.
So what predicate would it be then? It's not.
Well, you know, like when we had the one about sound, is impermanent. It's just impermanent. It's not is impermanent. It's just impermanent. Impermanent is the predicate, not is impermanent. Just impermanent. So I think it might be the same. Deeper understanding.
Or just understanding.
Yeah, deeper understanding seems right. And because of listening to teachings. So then the thesis is I will get deeper understanding. That's the thesis.
Yep.
And the criteria, the presence of this reason in the subject, the
I listen
C to applies to A. A is C. So receiving teachings can apply to A. You can do that.
Yeah.
A is C. You are not teachings.
Yeah, you are not teaching.
But you're capable of teaching. It's kind of like smoke also isn't fire. There's two kinds of these pervasions. Anyway, close enough.
Next one.
It must be B.
Give the teachings.
Yeah, this was hard. This is the other kind of pervasion, where it's one that is not is.
Yeah.
It's not like a copulative one, they said. It's the one that is more related. I can't remember the name of it. It's like smoke isn't fire, but when there's smoke, there's fire.
There is fire, yeah.
So
it's that kind.
Right, it's the result.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's associated. There's a relationship, but I don't know the exact words for it.
Otherwise, hearing, thinking, imagining would be true.
But it seems like these things do go together. Like, you know, you can't really deny if you hear teachings, you'll get deeper understanding. That's a possibility. It's not like if you turn on a light bulb, you'll get deeper understanding. Well, maybe you would. If you go to sleep,
it seems
like they're related.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if it cannot be, let's see. If it is not B, it cannot be C.
You don't listen to teachings, you don't have deeper understanding.
You don't listen to teachings.
That's true.
Well,
they did in the previous lives.
Yeah.
They actually studied a lot.
A lot. Previous lives.
And they just woke it up.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you. Yeah, that's good. That's good. The wheels are creaking. Okay, so let's move on to the next question. What are the three types of phenomena in reference to inferences?
Evidence.
Yes.
Slightly obscure.
And very obscure.
It's an example of evident.
Hopes, desires.
Okay.
Internal pain.
Maitri's looking at the small particles of matter on the carpet.
These are evident.
Yep. Slightly obscure phenomena.
Emptiness.
So
Okay. And very obscure.
Karma.
Is there anything else that anybody
had
for that one?
Okay,
here.
Yeah.
When you were born. You can use logic on that one. I think Venerable said that.
Yeah.
But the cause of rebirth is very right, because you have to be able to know someone's karma.
Oh,
because of a particular rebirth.
Yeah, for a particular rebirth, you mean. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause of a rebirth, or, period.
Or maybe also, you know, the cause of the result that we're experiencing in this life. Is that a very good phenomenon?
The specific causes.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The specific causes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go on to the threefold analysis. Let me talk first a little bit about this one. We're talking about inference by authoritative testimony. So this one is used to gain knowledge about very obscure phenomena, those that we are unable to know by means of direct perceivers or inference by the power of the fact. This particular type of inference uses the word of people whom we have examined and determined to be reliable authorities on the subject as a reason to accept something as true. And the example, I think this was from Geshe Tekchok, used was someone who wants to enroll in a school trusts the instructions given by the people working at the administrative office to tell them what procedures to follow. The validity of this inference hinges upon the reliability of the person whose testimony we're trusting. Such a person should know the information, have no cognitive disability, be someone who tells the truth. So we have a responsibility to examine the qualifications and not believe blindly. And when used in spiritual practice, then this form of inference can be called inference by belief or scriptural inference. And it involves using reliable scriptural passages in order to understand particular points that cannot be understood otherwise. So it's used in cases where the topic is very obscure, cannot be known by other cognizers, and it's important to understand so that we can progress spiritually. Topics such as subtle workings of the law of karma, the subtle layout of the bodhisattva paths and grounds, the inexpressible qualities of the resultant state of enlightenment. And so to correctly infer that a scriptural passage is accurate and free from fault, we must test it by means of the threefold analysis. And so what is this threefold analysis?
One, we see that there's no reason to reject the scripture in terms of how it presents evident phenomena. Mm-hmm. We see there's no reason to reject the scripture in terms of its presentation of slightly obscure phenomena, i.e. we analyze the presentation and see if it can be refuted by inference of power of the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Three, there's no reason to reject the scripture in terms of its presentation of very obscure phenomena, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, we check whether the explicit and implicit meanings are free from contradiction.
Yeah.
And then we check whether the former and latter passages are free from contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Do you have examples of those last two?
Yeah, the example of this is straight from the text, right? So the Heart Sutra is an example of the implicit or implicit. So the explicit meaning is wisdom, and the implicit meaning is method.
Method, yeah.
And then the B is what a sutra says in one place doesn't contradict what it says in another place. However, I had a big question that came up when I was writing this out.
Uh-huh.
And that was how this applies, or does this apply, in the case of the three turnings of the wheel, where we recognize that the Buddha taught many different approaches about what is the nature of reality. So you have to have a commentary or an interpretation to understand that these are not contradictory, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where does that sit in all of this?
Yeah, that's a good.
The three turnings of the wheel in particular, though, what you said.
Yeah, you know how we studied that, you know, the Buddha said it one place. Phenomena are inherently existent.
That's
and so forth and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a good explanation of why that's not contradictory, but you have to have a commentary on it.
Mm-hmm.
Since it's
So it's just a question about how does that fit with it?
How does that fit with it? Yeah.
Let me save that one. I mean, we will save that
one. We will save that one for Ben Richard, yeah.
Can you explain the threefold analysis again first?
I can go through kind of exactly what Vinoba Chuni just said, yeah. So the first, you mean the, just go over the three again? Yeah. So the first, there is no reason to reject this scripture in terms of its presentation of evident phenomena. To assess this, we examine if its presentation of evident phenomena can be refuted by direct perception. The second, there is no reason to reject this statement or text in terms of its presentation of slightly obscure phenomena. To assess this, we examine if its presentation of slightly obscure phenomena can be refuted by inference by the power of the fact. The third, there is no reason to reject this statement or text in terms of its presentation of very obscure phenomena. And to assess this, we examine two factors. In the presentation of very obscure phenomena, the explicit and implied meanings are free from contradiction. The explicit meaning is the evident theme of the scripture, while the implicit meaning is other topics that are the basis. And so, for example, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the explicit meaning is the doctrine of emptiness, the implicit meaning is the stages of the paths, which are the progressive levels of realization of emptiness. And then in the presentation of very obscure phenomena, the former and latter passages are free from contradiction. That is, if what the scripture says in one place does not contradict what it says in another. And then Venerable Children, that's where she brought up the thing about Vulture's Peak, that when you see it, all those people could not be on that small peak or small hill, really, mountain. So, you know, how does that happen? And so then you realize that many of the beings were highly realized and were in different form than these gross bodies on the hill.
And that was considered to be evident phenomena to Bodhisattva.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, evident phenomena to a bodhisattva, yeah. So evident phenomena and then slightly obscure phenomena are really the first choices in gaining knowledge. In scriptural inference, you know, that's not the first choice, you know. Okay, so now we'll go on to subsequent cognizers. So a little bit about subsequent cognizers. So the first moment of a direct perceiver comprehends its object through the force of experience. The first moment of an inference does so in dependence on a sign. For both of these types of perception, later moments within the same continuum of perception, while still apprehending the same object, no longer rely on either experience or a sign, but are merely induced through the force of the first moment of cognition. The strength of the initial realization has not been lost, and therefore subsequent cognizers are incontrovertible knowers that do realize their objects. The element of realization is not gained through their own power, for they themselves do not do the removing of superimpositions, which enables realizations to occur. Rather, they realize that which has already been realized by the former moment of consciousness, which has already removed the superimposition and which induces them. So, the next question, a mind on the path of seeing goes to the path of meditation in the same session, in the same continuity. The next session of meditative equipoise, the first moment of realizing emptiness, is it a prime cognizer or a subsequent cognizer? And what is the second moment? Yeah?
Is it a debate about this?
Yeah?
According to which school?
Debatable. Debatable. Yeah. So, yes, debatable.
Tantrika says that it's a subsequent cognizer, and Prasangika says it's a prime cognizer. Is that true?
No,
it's
not
within
the school. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. I couldn't find my notes. Does somebody have the notes right on it? I can do it from memory.
Well, one.
Do you have it?
Well, yeah, I think I do. She said that when you get to the path of seeing and have direct perception of emptiness, what kind of mind is that? A yogic, reliable, direct perceiver.
Right.
If you end a meditation session, break, and later come back on the same object, is it the first moment or a subsequent cognizer? Some people say it's a prime cognizer because you're newly generating a continuum of a direct perceiver. Others say that it's a subsequent cognizer because you're engaging in an object due to the force of the previous inference you had.
That was the discussion that even, you know, all the way through that path of what? All of those going through the for the bodhisattva grounds, there were subsequent cognizers until you got to
way, way high. I forget.
Well, as you go through each one of them, and then you're a subsequent cognizer for eons as you go to the next ground.
And she also said, if you had an inference in a previous life and you had it in this lifetime, I think the first moment would be a prime cognizer because it's this life. You'd still have to think about it a bit and realize it. But she said both reasons made sense to her. So what are the two types of conceptual subsequent cognizers?
One is by direct perceiver.
And what are the four direct subsequent cognizers?
Sense, mental, apperceptive, and yoga.
Yes. And the two conceptual subsequent cognizers?
And this is where you have to induce or
induce by inference.
Yeah, those induced by direct perceiver and those induced by inference. Yep. And so the last question, when we see something, then we think about it. What type of cognizer is it?
Subsequent cognizer induced by a visual direct perceiver.
A conceptual subsequent cognizer induced by a direct perceiver. So what's an example?
One of the examples is that looking at the color of the blue on the Garika outfits, and then going to India and Ruby and her trying to remember what color that was to get a fabric that matched it. Well, she and I had the same experience.
Pardon?
Well, she and I had the same subsequent conceptual
So it is relevant to our lives, see? So we can see how not so accurate our generic images are. Not so accurate.
That kind can be very great, right? With a subsequent cognizer. I don't know, I have in my notes that a conceptual subsequent cognizer is induced by a sense direct perceiver soon. So the example is seeing green, then thinking green soon after.
Yeah.
There's such a huge lag time that you go to India, that becomes memory.
Yeah, that's memory.
Well,
you're right.
Was that an example, though, because she did use that as a direct visual, direct perceiver, and then going to India and recalling it conceptually and trying to remember the image.
So maybe so.
That was her example, yeah. So that's a good question to see if that's memory or... What length of span of time? Because certainly, the longer it goes, the more inaccurate the image gets. I think. Yeah. Okay, we've used our time.
Good job, Tisha.
Thank you.
Good job.
Due to the Spirit, may we soon obtain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.